The views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD presents Campus Voices, conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon.
Thank you, Jason. After all these years of knowing him, I still maintain that Assistant Professor of Art John Cox is one of the most interesting people on campus. He's one of the very few people I know who've been to all seven continents. He's led study abroad trips to six of them, every continent except
Europe.
We could talk with John about entomology. Yes, he used to be bug boy when he was an undergraduate. Photography, his profession, and one of the subjects he teaches now, digital photography, Tanzania, Vietnam, Peru, Maasai warriors, Hadza tribesmen, wildebeest migration patterns, the Philadelphia Flower Show, teaching methods of helping indigenous tribes preserve their culture while finding a way to exist in the modern world, and on and on. Welcome back to Campus Voices, John.
Thank you, Rich. I appreciate it.
Today you're going to tell us about two of the projects you're currently involved in, a cultural mapping project in Peru, and being the first UD faculty member to teach a massive open online course, a MOOC. Tell us about this tribe whose culture you've been helping map.
Okay, so this tribe is called the Ecija, and they're in the Madre de Dios region of Peru, and this is in the Amazon basin. And I met with them about 2 years ago, and I learned first about them through the Amazon Center for Environmental Education and Research. I met with the president of that organization, and he suggested that I start working on a project with him based off of the Hadza book that I did several years ago. So I said, sounds like a great idea. I took my initial trip down to Peru with a summer scholar through UD's program, and we went down and basically met the tribe, and we spent about a week with them and decided whether or not they would even be interested in a cultural mapping project, if it would fit with their kind of motive for how they're moving forward in this new day and age where hunter-gatherers are finding it increasingly more difficult to survive. And as it turned out, they had just formed in May, they had just formed the Ecija Nation, and they had banded three separate communities together to act as one. So this is something that they were really interested in, and cultural mapping, cultural preservation was one of their top goals.
What are the pressures on this tribe? I mean, is it loggers? What's going on?
Yeah, there's a huge amount of pressures. Part of it's logging. Part of it's the mining industry is polluting their waters. They do a fair amount of fishing, too, to get their protein that they need. There's a lot of mercury in the water now, which is not a good thing. I think there's something like 38 tons of mercury just in that one region that gets put in every year. It's a lot of illegal miners that are doing it, so they're going into the forest, they're digging holes, and then they use mercury, which binds to the gold, and then they either dump the mercury off, but they also burn the mercury off, turns into a vapor, and then it comes back down and pollutes the waters as rain.
As rain,
yeah.
Wow.
So it's really a terrible situation. That, in addition to just losing a ton of their land. So other people have moved in, agriculturalists, eco-lodges, different people that have extraction purposes within the forest that are moving in, taking their land. The government's taken a lot of their land. So they're really reserved down to a small portion of their original home range. So what we were doing is going in and taking the elders of that tribe and mapping their traditional lands, getting all the stories, taking GPS coordinates along the way, figuring out where they used to be and then where they're condensed to now. It was never in the plan that they could survive on such a small tract of land. As hunter-gatherers, the whole idea is they're moving from place to place to get the resources that they need, where when you put them in a small area, it's much more difficult for them to have enough to live how they used to live. So it kind of restricts them to a life of poverty in our eyes.
You start to anticipate my next question, which is really, what does it mean to do cultural mapping? But you start to answer that. It's like mapping out the area mm-hmm. where the culture used to exist compared to where it is now and that mm-hmm. kind of thing?
Absolutely. It's so mapping the tangible, but also the intangible resources. So what are the songs? What are the oral histories? What are their creation stories?
So like where they come from and that kind of thing?
Where they come from, like the Ecija came from a thread in the sky, a cotton thread that climbed down. And the elders in that tribe still can point to the exact spot in the forest where that happened. One of the women we were with said, my mom told me that her mom came from the sky. So it doesn't go that far back, but one of those interesting things that you learn along the way. We learned that there is three different worlds that the Essieha have. So there's a kind of like a heaven world where Essieha still live. The most beautiful people live in the upper world. There's the land world, and then there's the underwater world. So in the underwater world, the Essieha people use something like an anaconda as a hammock. So there are Essieha living in all three worlds currently, and they still believe this. So wow. That's part of one of the intangible resources that you're mapping when you're doing a cultural mapping project.
But when you're mapping and you're looking at what villages have come up with what versions of this kind of story, that kind of thing.
Right, and trying to condense it all down. But like I said, when you're talking about something like that, the Essieha coming down from that thread in the sky and the elders can point to that specific location, you can put a GPS coordinate on that and then say, look, this is actually part of their ancestral home range, in hopes that the government might either at least give them access to go to that sacred area or maybe even get some land back.
I take it that the government of Beru has not exactly been helping them keep their native range.
No, basically what they did is they set up three tight communities, and they did give them a title to their land, but one of the problems is that the government still owns rights to the logs, the minerals, and the water. So a land title doesn't really mean a whole lot.
You can have the land, you just can't breathe the air, use the trees, or drink the water.
Right. And you know, hopefully this project will help to kind of change that a bit.
One of the things I think that's interesting about your project is this is just not John Cox, University of Delaware faculty member, going on another walkabout on another continent. This is something that's been funded by the National Geographic Society in part as well.
Mm-hmm. Correct. I was the co-recipient of a National Geographic Genographic Legacy Fund. So you've probably heard about some of these DNA kits that you can get and swab your cheek. Well, the proceeds of that go to fund projects like this. So that's where part of the funding came from. And then there was also, we had 10 cultural mapping members on our trip with us, most of which were connected to UD and then all of the indigenous people as well.
Looks like you had the mother of a UD student, you had some UD alum, you had some UD students, you had some UD faculty.
Mm-hmm.
This was a really multidisciplinary event.
Yeah, so we had Dr. Rosalie Rolland Dow from education, Dr. Carla Montero-Guerón from anthropology, and the three of us each had a student that came with us, and that was funded from the UD Summer Scholars Program, and it was a pilot program that they just started this year. So that's multiple students working on one project at the same time. So it was a different model for them, and in the end, in August, the students presented this project not as individuals, but they presented it as a group. So we took up the whole hour of the presentation, and students basically said what their part was. So we had Lindsay Yeager from art. We had Brian Griffiths from engineering and plant science. We had Chelsea Rosansky from anthropology, and we had Morgan Lear from education.
So this was, the students had the opportunity to collaborate across colleges, across disciplines, on a real project out in the sticks.
Out in the sticks. And the video that came out of this was shot by some of the students. The voiceover was Brian Griffiths. Lindsay Yeager did a lot of the editing. They all worked on the script together, and now it's on the National Geographic website, so that's pretty cool. And one of the videographers on the trip, Steve Ziegler, he was a comm student, and he went to Tanzania with me, I believe, back in 2006, 2007. I can't really remember. And he's about 6'5", so his vantage point is pretty amazing compared to a lot of others when you're thinking about photography and videography.
You were talking a little bit about some of the things that the Essieha, am I saying that close to
correct?
Yeah,
it's pretty close, yeah.
Some things that they're trying to preserve. How do they see themselves fitting into the 21st century?
That's a great question. You know, there's three different communities, and one is fairly close to Puerto Maldonado, which is the largest city in that particular area. It's about a 45-minute drive, and it's connected by land. You can get there by vehicle. What they're trying to really do is hang on to their cultural heritage, because a lot of the kids are forgetting some of their bush skills. Whereas you move further up the river and you get more remote, their skills are still intact, so they have a different way that they're trying to navigate. When you get to the most remote community, you have incredibly intense timbering pressures on them, not coming from them themselves, but coming from outside timber companies that are moving in and basically taking the logs for absolutely nothing, and sometimes soliciting their help so they have a little money to get by. It's difficult because in Peru, all kids have to go to school. You have to pay for school uniforms as a hunter-gatherer. How do you make money? So it's one of the pressures that they're facing to try and fit with the rules and laws and regulation of today and still get by with those old ways of life.
There are Peruvian schools out in their area that they must send their children to. Mm-hmm.
So it's a permanent settlement that they're in because they're not allowed to move around their ancestral home range like they used to. So they have three permanent settlements. They live in permanent houses, but then they go into the forest during the day to capture their food. They have small chakras, small gardens that they'll grow some yucca. They have some coconuts, some sweet potatoes, things like that. But still a majority of their food is coming from the bush. When we were there, I think in one village in the middle, Palma Real, we probably saw 10 to 12 peccaries, which is a forest pig that came into the village within those couple days. So they're still gathering a lot of their food from out and about. And we went fishing with them. We gathered these vines and we poisoned fish and collected the fish. And then we had a little fish barbecue with them. So they still have all the knowledge there.
They don't sound like they use Scottish fly fishing technology.
they use so much different fishing technology. So that was just one method. They do have a long line that they put across a lake, and they'll do that. They'll just use a tiny little spear. We saw them do that. They'll use a hook and a pole. We saw them do that. We also saw them in the forest. There was a small puddle, and they gathered palm fronds, and they pushed all the water out of this puddle, and then they just gathered up the fish. So they're very ingenuitive with what they have, the materials that they have. And they had a whole bag of fish out of this one little puddle in the middle of the rainforest.
Those are some skills it'll be a shame to lose.
Mm-hmm. So that's part of this project, is to not just document where their ancestral lands were, but how their way of life was, because it is changing. And it has been changing over the last 100 years, basically when the rubber boom came in and you had rubber people set up these permanent settlements. Their culture started to change a lot.
Actually, if you look at books like Charles Mann's 1491 or 1493, they talk about that exploitation of the rubber plantations all over the Amazon region.
There's even a river in the Madre de Dios region called Baltimore, but they call it Baltimore because the rubber people came down and they would mark all the boxes of the rubber that they were taking Baltimore, and then they would be put on a ship and sent on the river to Baltimore eventually, Baltimore, Maryland.
So wow.
Just odd connection that we figured out when we were down there.
We're talking with John Cox from UD's Department of Art. One of the things I think is really remarkable about your work, I know this from your work in Tanzania and other places, that you feel that a photographer can really have a positive influence in the world. And how has your photography helped these people?
Well, so far with the SEAHA, it's just giving them more of a global audience. So we're working with a lawyer in Washington, D.C., and she's presenting their case to one of the human rights hearings in late October, early November. So she's using the material that we gathered, the data we gathered, the images, the stories, to help solidify her case. And hopefully, if the case gets accepted, then it'll be heard in an international court. And as far as I know, we have two of the elders and from the SEAHA coming up with that. So they'll be up in October, November, and I'm hoping to bring them to UD.
Do the SEAHA have any concerns about having their pictures taken or being videoed?
So we went through, first our entire group went through an IRB process, so we got the whole project approved by them. All the students involved in the project also went through that process. And then we had meetings that would last anywhere from 3 hours to an entire day every time we went to a new community of the SEAHA, explaining the project. All the elders and all the people involved from the initial stages knew what was going on, but then we had to explain it to the rest of the community. So we would have sometimes 40 and 50 people at a meeting for several hours up to a day long, explaining the process, explaining what we were going to do, and explaining that in the end they're going to hold the copyright to the book and the materials. So it truly is theirs. It's not something that we're going to use. Any of the proceeds from the book are also going to be turned into a fund and an educational programming mechanism for them to help navigate this new world.
When you and I talked a couple of years ago about some of the people you've worked with in Tanzania, you were talking about how one of my favorite bits was you were talking about Maasai warriors finding a way to make money with solar charging stations for cell phones. Are the SEAHA finding anything like that, or are they just really trying to preserve their insular way of life?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So the women in the Palma Real community specifically are doing a lot with indigenous materials that they're collecting, and they're making a lot of baskets, things that they were making anyway, but now they're turning them into a profit-making venture. And they have several people from the outside that are working with them, Peruvian people from Lima, Peruvian people from Puerto Maldonado, that have been working with the community anyway, and it's kind of a mechanism for them to help the SCAHA, help the women especially get the money. In fact, the place where we camped, our whole cultural mapping team, camped in a small building that the women had created because of the money that they got from all their baskets and their arts that they were doing. They do a lot of jewelry, and it's all things that are coming directly from the rainforest, even the dyes that they have. So this one, it's called Siripanga, and it's green leaves, and then as soon as you mash them up, they turn this bright purple, and that's how they dye the baskets. So Vicky Kassman in Art History is actually going to take all the materials and objects that we collected while we were there, and her students are going to start documenting them, documenting the basically the order that they're in, so the quality of what they are. And so that's another tool that this project is doing, that students are also getting more experience based off of it, that I'm kind of just handing everything over. We documented everything with who did each one. So if there's a basket, we took the name down of the artist. We took the materials down of the artist. If there was a necklace, what seeds were used. So things like that.
Now, are you going to ever take a whole class down to Peru?
January.
You know, that was my next question. Now, Sarah, the intern, has been on study abroad trip. You went to?
London.
She went to London. See, John's study abroad trips are always a little bit different.
Yeah.
You know, if on one of John's study abroad trips, if you're not pushing a Jeep out of the mud, it ain't happening.
It's probably not going to work out.
So who are you taking down in January of 2015?
So 2015, Dr. Jake Bowman from Entomology and Wildlife Ecology and I are running a program to, basically it's the confluence of the Amazon, so it's called the Europa Lodge. It was a lodge that was set up as a research center from Cornell, and then it's recently been turned over into an eco lodge, but they still have a laboratory. So we rented the whole lodge out for 21 days. So it's a different model for us. What we're going to do is bring all of our guest speakers, in addition to some Peruvian students, to the lodge to talk to our students. And then from there, we get in canoes and head out into the rainforest and go from there. There's also three indigenous communities around the lodge that we'll also be visiting and working with.
One of the other things that John Cox is doing that's very interesting is you're going to be the first UD professor to teach a MOOC. A massive open online course.
That's correct.
What the heck are you going to be doing with that?
So this started, I'm going to blame Ralph Begleiter for this one.
He's always a good one to blame.
He's a good one to blame. So this started about a year and a half ago, I believe, and we had lunch, and we were talking about some of the different things I was doing, and I told him I was teaching this online class, and he said, have you ever thought about a MOOC? I said, well, I thought about it. And he said, well, you should really think about it. And then I did, and I worked on this IT transformation grant, and it got accepted. So over the last year and a half, I've been basically updating and working on that. So right now, it's three different sections, and the way we're going to run it is 3 5-week sections. So this is going to be the first section that runs. So far, I just checked. I think I have about 500 students that have registered. Registration just started about 10 days ago. It's closed caption in English, and thanks to one of my Peruvian friends that was on the Peruvian project, she's from Ecuador, Carla Montero Guerrón, translated everything into Spanish, so now it's also closed captioned in Spanish, so that was pretty cool of her to do that for me.
For those listeners who aren't familiar with the idea, MOOCs are massive open online courses are, sometimes you get academic credit, sometimes you don't, but the idea is that there could be 500, there could be 10,000 people in the course, and you're all learning together in sort of a modular format and doing most of the work online and collaborating and that kind of thing. And I think our intern, Chris Johnson, has some questions he wants to ask you about some of those aspects of the upcoming MOOC.
Sounds good.
Can you tell me about the basis of the course, what you're going to be covering?
Yes. So this first 5-week section is basically going to be learning how to see photographically. So you're going to be learning about composition, you're going to be learning about lighting, and you're going to be learning about color and how all three of those ingredients come together to create a photograph. I have optional lectures for anyone that's using a digital SLR. So that's one of the cameras that you can change lenses and you're able to change your shutter speed and your f-stop. Those are all optional lectures, but my main goal is for people to learn how to see photographically. Which brings me to the point that anyone can take this that has a phone that can take a photograph. I think more people now have taken photographs with phones than anything else.
So what do you think is the difference between photography and what you call phonography?
Well, phonography is basically just with your phone. That's a good question. But for me, it's all photography, and the phone is just a tool. In the end, I don't really care what you shot it with. I'm more interested in the image and the impact of the image than I am about the technical elements of the device that you're using. It's always the person behind the device for me that makes the difference.
Are there some differences that come out from the ability to have this little thing that can fit in a shirt pocket and versus, you know, a bag with 13 lenses in it?
Yeah, for one, you always have it with you, right? How many people leave the house without their phone? Not many. So you always have that ability to take a photograph. I find myself pulling over at random times because I don't necessarily carry my big digital SLR with me, but I do always have my phone, and I shoot with it all the time now. Your kids especially, you can be a lot more discreet when you're taking photographs than before. So if I approach you with a big 35 millimeter lens, you might go, whoa. Whereas if I walk up and I'm just with my phone, you're not really going to think it's a big deal. So you can get into intimate settings a little bit easier, I think, with your phone than you can with a big digital SLR. Now, if you had asked me this question 10 years ago, I probably would have said something totally different. But my mind's changed along the way. Part of it is because the technology has gotten so good, and the image quality that comes out of a phone now is just pretty amazing, and what you can do with it.
So after you cover all of the composition techniques and everything, your students, are they going to be taking pictures for the class?
So each week, students have to come up. I call it the dozen challenge, dozen photo challenge. Mm-hmm. So each week, students have to take 4 images, and then they upload it to a website. So everyone in the class has to create a website and showcase their work. So what I found this summer is the quality of the work improved dramatically because I kind of did a dry run of how the course would work. The quality of the work improved dramatically because I think people had to put it out there in a public domain where they didn't just have to turn it into me, a face that they're not going to see. They had to share it with the rest of the world, and I think that made a huge difference.
What are some of the technical issues that are different about using a cell phone for phonography than using even a point-and-shoot camera?
Sometimes they're not as fast. Sometimes you hit the wrong button. So some phones now have the ability to take the shot with your thumb on one of the volume buttons, so that's great. Technically, you can do a lot more with the image right after the fact, after you shoot. So the editing process begins right away with a phone, not necessarily with your camera. So you can edit. I have Photoshop on my phone. I have all sorts of different apps that you can use. So you can edit it right there and then upload it to anywhere that you want.
Now, I got to ask, because I'm interning with IT, what website are you using to host your photos?
So I'm going to use Weebly for all the students are hosting their photos on, but then there's also the fifth week is an Instagram that all the students have to use too. Okay. It's the most widely used one, and it's so easy to use, and now all different phones accept it. So that was one of my other requirements. It has to be easy. One thing that's been really exciting for me just with the development of the MOOC is I've been passing it around to all the different contacts I have around the world. So one of my Cambodian guides when we were there was taking pictures nonstop along the way, and he just really loved it. So I sent him a Facebook message, and I said, hey, I'm starting this MOOC class. Are you interested? And he said, yeah, what's the link? And then I immediately saw all these Cambodian names show up. So he not only himself signed up, but there's a lot of other Cambodians that are going to be taking the course.
Well, we're talking to you on August 28th. Registration opened about August 18th. The class is scheduled to start September 8th, and you've already got almost
500.
Wow.
How many of those are from UD?
You know, I went through the list. I didn't do an actual count, but I saw there may have been 50 names that I recognized.
Are they getting UD credit for that?
So with the MOOC itself, no, but I'm also having my students that are taking my Art 180 class interact with the MOOC students. Okay. So there's kind of a two-tiered system right now. Eventually, I'd like it to be a three-tiered system where you had a free section, maybe a section that students were getting it for some sort of professional development credit, and then the full-blown
academic credit.
And there'd be different level of interaction among myself and the students based on what level of the course they were taking.
Now, is this going to be like one of those MOOCs where people can start it, stop it, drop it in the middle, or do you see it as literally a 5-week progression that you want them to go through?
The way I organize it, that's a great question, but the way I organize it, there is a progression. Because I think with photography, there is a progression on how you begin to see.
I was just asking because I think that's one of the differences between some of the really, really large MOOCs and some of the ones that the people are taking or learning about a subject in a MOOC for academic credit.
Mm-hmm.
That the really, really large ones, it's like you see a low completion rate
mm-hmm.
because people are coming in for just the one or two pieces that they're interested in.
Right. And honestly, we'll see where that goes. We'll see how this audience takes to the progression of the course. I think part of it is if they invest enough time to set up their website, because that's the first actual assignment, then they're probably going to be more likely to complete the course than if they just jump in on part two or part three of that.
What are you finding most exciting about teaching photography online to 500 to 2,000 people?
For me, one of the reasons why I started the MOOC is I wanted to diversify my student body. I always had the intention that my students at Delaware would be interacting with this MOOC audience. And I think it's going to work out already by seeing the variety of names that are coming up. I'm seeing a lot of Indian names. I'm seeing a lot of Cambodian names. I sent it to all my friends in Tanzania, so I've seen a couple of them have started. I sent it to, this was really exciting for me, I sent it to my Peruvian contacts, and I said, wouldn't it be great if one of the hunter-gatherers, because they go into town and they have phones, wouldn't it be great if one of them could take it, and then they could start taking over this cultural mapping project and taking even more ownership of it. And I saw two Mishiha names show up, which is an Seiha name. So I know at least two of them are taking the course. So whether or not they'll be completely actively involved or not is, you know, for me, it was diversifying the UD student body. And so far, I think that's going to work out.
You've done a lot of different things, like the things you've done with the urban spaces at the Philadelphia Flower Show and then, you know, building those things in downtown Wilmington. It's almost like this is an extension of that, and that, you know, here's this device everybody's using. Look what power that camera gives you on it.
Basically, it's a mechanism for change that people have in their hands, and maybe they just didn't know they had the ability to do it. So hopefully this will steer people in that direction. You know, we communicate with images every day, and we just live in this society that's just inundated with images. So for me, taking a good image that means something and has composition that draws you in and tells a story and can make a difference, that would be great for me to see more images like that.
So I was looking at the course description for your class. It's being hosted on canvas.net, right?
Correct.
And so it's split up into three parts. Can you tell me about who any of your guest speakers that are coming in some of the later parts of the class are?
Yes. As long as this first one goes well and the first section of the MOOC goes well, we'll probably run the first section again because it's a beginning section. And then we'll move into section two, which is criticizing photography. And one of my guest speakers there is Terry Barrett, which is a famous photo critic. He wrote a book called Criticizing Photography. So students have to basically identify some of the different categories of photographs that there are out there. And then they have to create a multimodal presentation based on this whole topic of criticizing photography. And then the last part is really finding your own voice. And one of the interviews that we already have captured is from Griffin Lotz. He was a former UD art student, went to Tanzania with me, and he now is the photo editor at Rolling Stone. So he's done pretty well for himself. And he interned at Rolling Stone for, I think, 3 weeks, and then his boss quit. And guess what? He got a job.
Maybe that'll happen with you, Richard.
You know, you shouldn't be encouraging my interns like that. John Cox from the art department here at the University of Delaware when he's not in Tanzania, Vietnam, Cambodia. You're just all over the place. John, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.